Right. Thank you. Okay, well, it's a very interesting field. Tonight we're going to be speaking on the cardiovascular system, the heart of the matter, and the number one cause of death. And you're going to learn some things that maybe are going to shock you just a wee bit, and particularly a $24 million study that we're going to speak about. Today's topics we're going to be covering. Okay, aspects of conductivity. That's because we have, the heart's an electrical piece of equipment, and it has conductions through it, just like it was wired. Valve problems and their consequences, including cardiovascular accident or stroke. Fatty issues, cause and correction. Pipe pressures, and you have to remember that your pipes or your arteries are not fixed diameter pipes. They're pipes that are very flexible and have capability of expanding and contracting. The new physiology of fluid significance and blood pressure, and this one might surprise a lot of you, and heart attack and survival. And when you look at the heart, it's an absolutely amazing organ. It's a four-chambered pump with flexible valves between the chambers. And they look a bit like parachutes because they have little cords holding on some of the edges of these valves, and they call it chordae tendinae. And the heart contains a self-activated generator with no rotating magnets, no rotating rotors, no rotating commutators. Okay? It's got an internal wiring system, an electromagnetic field measured as far as 8 feet from your body with the new equipment. And just out of interest, did you know if I came down, and there's a blonde gal I know there, so she won't mind me saying that, but if I came down and held her hand, and they put an EEG on her brain, and since I just feel good looking at her, then my heartbeat can be picked up on her EEG, her brain waves. Isn't that interesting? Okay? And the pump beats approximately 40 million times per year. That's quite a pump. Okay? Well, heart disease claims about 80,000 lives per year and accounts for close to 40% of all deaths in Canada. And of those killed by coronary disease, get this, approximately 50% have low or normal cholesterol levels. And about 85% of people who have a high cholesterol will not develop coronary heart disease at all. Isn't that interesting? Now we have a map of the human heart coming up. And at night, day and night, the muscles of your heart contract and relax to pump blood throughout your whole body. Blood returns to the heart. It flows a complicated pathway. It's not that complicated in a way, but there you can see it. We'll just leave it on long enough. And I forgot to bring my little thing out of my case. It's that little pointer. Yeah, it's in the case. I threw it in there. Okay, but notice here that, okay, the heart has just gone up to the body through the aorta. Here it's coming through the body into the left ventricle. It went into the left atrial, left ventricle. Boy, it's going awful fast. We must get this guy's heart to slow down a bit. He's getting all excited. Okay, this is the represents the atrium, the right atrium, where the blood goes first. It goes into the ventricle. Let's wait till it does. It gets into the ventricle. There it goes through this valve, pumped up through to the lungs, comes back here from the lungs into the left atrium, left ventricle. Now it goes shooting out through the rest of the body. Okay? So you've got that. That's the way, and I think that's pretty good on there if it showed. Now, early physiologists noted that the heart muscle contracted if calcium was injected into the heart muscles. And note two, they noted as well that to keep an isolated heart beating, they had to have calcium in the fluid that was going through the heart. Okay? Then the point was that calcium is necessary for your heart muscle contraction. So, guess what? If you're low calcium intake, you're going to have maybe a little bit of problem with your heart beat. But calcium is not enough. In order for the heart to utilize calcium, you need this stuff here called calmodulin, okay? No calmodulin, no heartbeat, no contraction. And here's the big thing. Even if the calcium in the diet is okay and its absorption is okay, you still won't get a good heartbeat if you're absent in calmodulin. Calmodulin, one of the highest sources, is ordinary garden peas. Isn't that interesting? So ordinary garden peas, so don't be afraid of shelling those characters, because you need those for a good heartbeat. Potassium, that's a mineral, mostly in cells, all right? And if extracellular potassium becomes low, it causes depolarization of muscle cell membranes. What do they mean by that? Well, it makes the membranes, the potassium, move. This makes heart muscle cells twitchy or excitable, and therefore tending to an irregular heartbeat. So we must have an adequate potassium outside of cells for cardiac stability. In other words, you don't want to have a heart that's just like this and then suddenly starts to beat on its own and not regularly. And if you're low in potassium and then you happen to be a coffee drinker, that's enough to send you off and you can have very irregular heartbeats. Okay? So you won't find this fellow very interested in coffee drinking. It does that to my ticker. So, and particularly if in the winter time when we haven't had some of those fresh garden peas around. And besides that, it dissolves your bone. And I always say to my patients, if only when they flush the toilet, they could hear the bones rattling as they go down, then they wouldn't be drinking so much coffee. Okay. Well, everyone with a much decrease, we said that, of potassium show damage and degeneration of the heart muscle similar to those who have had a heart attack. So you do not want to be low in potassium. No way. Where do you get potassium? Well, a baked potato has 435 milligrams if you eat the skin. If you don't eat the skin, you're not going to get much potassium, okay? We all know that bananas have potassium, fruit has potassium, but a baked potato with the skin has more than the banana or the most fruits that you want to have, okay? Well, Hanselier, I remember talking to him years ago, showed that pretreatment with potassium allowed survival in animals subjected to the same stress that killed by heart attack those not pre-treated with potassium. So if their potassiums were low, their stress tended to give them more heart attacks than if their potassium levels were high. So we must be sure that we're getting a good potassium. It's rather interesting, we'll come to that later tonight, that people that are on diuretics or the so-called water pill, if their potassiums are low, they have 2.6 more chance of getting a fatal heart attack than if their potassium levels were reasonably high. Okay? Premature ventricular contraction, well, that's the so-called PVCs, and I don't know whether you know what that means. That means that the normal heart would contract, but if it contracts without getting the message from the electrical current from the atria, or the top part of the heart, to the bottom part, if it contracts on its own, so it's not waiting for the electrical signal to get down there, it's producing its own, so we call it premature ventricular contractions, are associated with low potassium. And those are extremely serious, because if you get into premature ventricular contractions, you get those just before you can get fibrillation, where the heart just goes like this, and unless someone's there to cardio virtue, you know, where they say stand back, and you see on TV, you see the guy's body jump up in the air when they say fires, presses the button, and unless you have that, they don't get you back. Much increased sodium, which is our highest source of sodium, is salt, tends to lead to a decreased potassium. One of the highest sources of potassium is kelp. Okay? Seaweed. Some 5.5 times higher than probably one of the next highest sources, raw sunflower seeds. Okay? Not roasted or salted. Because if you took the salt, then your salt's antagonistic to the potassium, so you don't want it salted. Next high potassium levels relative to sunflower seeds are wheat germ, baked potatoes that we already mentioned, almonds, parsley, and Brazil nuts. Ah, that's good. What are some early signs that you might be low in potassium? General weakness, impairment of neuromuscular function, poor reflexes, and soft, sagging muscles. In today's society, those soft, sagging muscles are not necessarily specific of potassium deficiency. Especially if you have a computer, okay? Later signs include insomnia, constipation, and a slow, irregular heartbeat. We don't like seeing that. Well, we should note that processed foods have a very high sodium-potassium ratio. Means that the sodium becomes far higher than the potassium in the processed food, whereas if you take it the way the Creator supplied it to you, it's the reverse. And I'll give you an example. If you were to take an apple, you're going to get 40 parts potassium to 1 part sodium. Now if you go to one of these fast food places and get what they call the apple pan fluffy or whatever it is, then you will find that there's 435 parts sodium to 1 part potassium. They've reversed our sodium-potassium ratio in all processed foods, not only just a little bit, but very, very dramatically. If you eat a tomato, you would get 44 parts potassium to 1 part sodium. If you go and buy tomato juice, it's in the hundreds of parts sodium to 1 part potassium. So it doesn't matter how you look at it, you are depressing your potassium ratio, sodium-potassium ratio, when this sodium is very, very high. And canned foods, you've all noticed that. I remember one of the reasons in a hospital, they have two nurses, they're not nurses, but they're two government employees that come into hospitals once a year, and they select the names of particular patients in that hospital, and they go up and they have to fill out reports, and they do this through all the hospitals in Alberta, of what the patient thinks of the hospital food and meals. And guess whose name they chose this time? I was in the hospital because I had a bad accident, and I was in an independent intensive care unit. They said, yes, you could talk to him, probably won't mind. So they came in there, and they said, what do you think of the soup? And my first answer was, well, 2 cubes of salt in a bowl of hot water doesn't impress me as being very nutritious soup. And they kind of looked at me, and I said, when we came in, you were chewing. What's this about? Well, I said, well, of course, I just had my dinner. For breakfast, they submitted yellow jello. For dinner, it was green jello. And they tell me I will get red jello for supper. And I said, the problem with jello is, number one, it has amino acids in it that are not complete. So you can't get the healing benefit from them. Number two, it's extremely high in sugar, which paralyzes the white blood cells that are supposed to be involved in part of your healing complex, so that won't do it. And number three, all of those jellos have dyes in them that have been submitted to the FDA because there's research out there showing that these dyes are quite possibly carcinogenic, and they should be tested it. So they've put it on their to be tested list. And they've been there, as I told them then, they've been there now 14 years, and they've done nothing about it. So they kind of looked at me, and they looked at one another, and said, what do we write on our report? They said, your answers are a lot different than the usual ones we get. So that was one thing. All right, well, the commonest cause for irregular heart rate is caffeine, particularly coffee. 6 or more cups a day will show a change in the ECG of a 250-pound athlete. We found that out at the University Hospital a number of years ago. Didn't matter how big the guy was. If he drank 6 cups of coffee, when we did his ECG, we could see where it had affected his heart conductivity. Low magnesium produces an irregular and dangerous heart rhythm. That one can kill you very quick, as will the either a very high or very low potassium will do the same. But this one is so common that, that people tend to miss out on it. And it's very, if we have time, someone can ask me about some research done in England that shows how important that is. My point with this slide is, be sure and take your calcium magnesium before you get your heart attack. It puts you in the survival group. And if you don't, if you're low in potassium, you're not in the survival group with your first heart attack, all right? Sudden death cases from coronaries frequently have both low magnesium and low potassium. So you know that you're going to have to eat a little better. Well, note that low magnesium is associated with soft or distilled water, and coronary death rate in various centers where those soft and distilled water are being used is increased. And it's in and that's particularly when they're, not if you take it once in a while, but if you're a chronic drinker of distilled water, you had better be sure that you're taking calcium magnesium. Low magnesium also leads to coronary spasm. That means it goes just like so. And of course, if it goes into spasm, it's cutting down the blood supply. You're not getting the oxygen from the red blood cells you should get. Then you get this pain. So it's a mineral frequently low in diabetics. So if you're a diabetic, you need to be sure you're taking magnesium more so than others. And diabetics, of course, also have an increased rate of atherosclerosis, which we'll talk about a little later. Now, low magnesium is also associated with an increase in total blood fats. It tends to be that way. If your cholesterol is high, it tends to indicate to us that your magnesium level is low. Okay? So a low magnesium is bad for more than one reason. Recalling that low magnesium is associated with dysrhythmia or an irregular heart rate. Patients with atrial fibrillation, remember the top part of those pumps are the atria, you have the right atria, left atria, and sometimes the atria will start to pump like this uncontrolled instead of the message going pump, and then the message going down to the ventricle, another pump, as you saw there. So people with atrial fib, coffee is a very big thing for producing atrial fib in patients, especially if they start going over 6 cups a day. In me, it'll cause it if I take half a cup a day, so I don't drink it. Patients with atrial fib low in magnesium require double the amount of digoxin for control, okay? That was the American Journal of Cardiology. Taurine is an amino acid, and it was called that because they first found it in bulls' hearts. So they named it after Taurus the bull. So they called it taurine. And it's an amino acid, most of which is found in the heart muscle. Okay? It's precursors. We tend to have precursors in our body that help to make this stuff. And the precursors are sulfur-containing amino acids found in beans, peas, there's our peas again, and lentils. Methionine in the fish, beef, and soybean. The interesting thing about taurine is that it prevents the loss of cell potassium. It doesn't allow that potassium to get out. Remember, if that stuff was low, then you were in danger. And therefore, it tends to prevent fibrillation and our premature ventricular contractions. Taurine also protects the heart from calcium overload. The thing with a calcium overload is this. If ever you get calcium going into cells where it does not belong, these cells, or the organs made up of those cells, go into spasm. Even if the cells are in the lining of your blood vessels, they will go into spasm if you get calcium going into them. Do you know what causes calcium to go into them too much? High vitamin D. Never take too high a vitamin D if you have heart problems, because that can make the blood vessels contract, your blood pressure can go up, and you can run into a real serious problem. The other thing with taurine is rather interesting. Sometimes you'll get a virus that affects the eye. My wife had that years ago, and I'll tell you what it looked like. When you looked at it with a magnifying glass, she looked like she had chicken pox on the surface of her entire eye. It was very painful. And they did everything they could at the ophthalmology place. So I finally sent down to Calgary because they had there a source of natural sterilized vitamin A drops. You put in the vitamin A drops, and what they couldn't do, the specialists couldn't do in a month, these did in 2 days. But taurine helps tremendously in that treatment as well. Taken by mouth. Not in eye drops in that case. And okay, so prevents the loss of cell potassium, therefore tends to prevent this fibrillation and people that have irregular heart rate from a premature ventricular contraction. Taurine also protects the heart from calcium overload, as we mentioned, so therefore it protects it from the spasm that you're going to get, or that some people get. And this is important because if taurine is low, it can be associated with an increased calcification of heart valves. Now, that's very significant. We have a young son, and he's run into that problem. And he had a stroke in his 40s. So this is a subject that's very close to my heart, because that brings it close to home. We've praised the Lord that he hasn't been left with bad problems, as far as we know, other than that his heart valve is badly calcified. So it results in smaller caliber of blood vessels. If you get increased calcification in blood vessels, therefore less blood supply, therefore less oxygen carried by the blood, and therefore the possibility of angina, where you're not getting enough oxygen to your heart muscle. Well, the drug commonly used for decreasing calcium is a calcium blocker called nifedipine or Adalat. And if rather than take magnesium, which has the only bad side effect it has, if you take too much, it gives you diarrhea. You take the right amount. One of the signs of magnesium deficiency is that if someone comes behind you and touches you, the kind of person that jumps about this high when you surprise them, that's a magnesium deficiency. If the doctor gets them in his office and he goes at their knees and they just kicks way up, magnesium deficiency. These people are okay, providing there's nothing matter with their heart, because if they ever have an irregular heart rate, boy, it can quit on them, going into fibrillation. So I had a group of pathologists when I sent a sample from one of my patients, and they just phoned me long distance right back from Chicago and said, your patient by the name of Mr. W, you had better get him on CalMag right away quick. if someone comes along and if he thumps his chest on a, that's a good way of doing it, isn't it, Matthew? He thumps his chest on the steering wheel when he puts on the brakes and he has an irregular heartbeat, this man won't survive. So they said, get him on. He's extremely low in magnesium. So we put him on magnesium right away, quick, also long distance. But as I say, if you take too much, you get diarrhea. If you're one of these people that gets a cramp in the bottom of your foot, that's characteristic of a fairly marked magnesium deficiency. The other thing that's a characteristic of magnesium deficiency is when you've gone to sleep okay, and then suddenly for some reason or other at about 3 o'clock in the morning you wake up. That's if you're not like me that's just going to bed then. And you wake up and say, now isn't this strange? I don't need to go to the washroom. Why did I wake up? No noise, no nothing. And you keep waking up every night that way. Takes about a week, and that finalizes you. That does not happen to you if you have an adequate magnesium after that, okay? But it takes about a week. Well, where were we? Drug commonly used. And the side effects of this drug, rather than taking magnesium, which doesn't have any bad side effects, if you take too much, you will get diarrhea, that's all. So it's a real marvelous treatment for chronic constipation. Birth defects in reproductive women by this drug, great increase of heart rate, which can lead to increased angina. They don't know why, but it can, and you're giving them the treatment for that, and here you're giving it the problem that you're wanting to treat. Heart failure from dilatation and therefore overloading the heart with too much blood, so the poor heart just fails on you. It just starts to get bigger and bigger and can't work anymore. Excess vasodilatation can lead to nausea, vomiting, dizziness, collapse. But in spite of these side effects, it has also saved some lives. We don't know how many it has not, or how many it may have just pushed over the border. Well, the natural cure, again, is magnesium, which prevents excess calcium from getting into the cells in the first place and producing the spasm that we've been talking about. And don't forget, again, that take too much. I have patients that take too much of everything. And one fellow, he said, well, I'm a bit constipated. So I said, okay, taking any calcium, magnesium? Nope. I said, okay, take 3 pills a day. So he took 3 pills a day. It solved his problem, but he's one of these that says, boy, I feel good. Well, maybe 18 would be better. I don't know where these guys... And then he phones up and he says, Doc, I can't get over my trots. He said, I got diarrhea all the time. I had a doctor that made that mistake with broad-spectrum vitamin C. It'll do the same, but if you take it too high. And he didn't believe me until I had him test it, and he believes me now. Okay, well, none of the aforementioned side effects have been noted in the use of nature's calcium blocker, which is magnesium. Don't take your calcium without magnesium unless under special circumstances. Well, there was a doctor in 1979, his name was Dr. Hilton, and he utilized taurine that we talked about, that amino acid from the beef heart, and he gave 12 patients that had chronic angina. They had deterioration of their ECGs. In other words, electrocardiograms were getting worse and worse and worse, and they were very low in potassium. So he put them on taurine. Remember we said taurine saves you from losing potassium? Well, 10 out of 12 had significant decrease in their angina. All of them had improved electrocardiograms, so that was a good sign, and it normalized the serum potassium in them. So the point is, taurine works well, okay? And becomes more effective with the use of magnesium that protects the heart from calcium overload into its cells and therefore having secondary spasm, okay, of those blood vessels, which will cut down the blood supply. So try magnesium and taurine first. It is simple, it's cheap, and it works. Now, you have to know how to take taurine. Taurine is an amino acid, and in beef heart, if you take it irregularly, and what we usually do, if you take it as a supplement, we say take 2 a day maximum. More than 2 a day, sometimes it gets your heart going and pumping just a little too hard, and you can feel it go whoomp, 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 and they don't like that whoomp, whoomp feeling, okay? And so what you do is you take 1 the first day, 2 the second, maybe 2 the third, then you stop. Then you for a day. Then you start all over and do the same thing. As long as you do it that way. I found over the years that if you didn't do it that way, the body after about a week says, oh, all you're giving me is some beef heart. And you lose its effectiveness. But if you vary the amount you give, about the time the body decides that, okay, all you're giving me is beef heart, you've cut it off, oh, then it's ready for what we'd call pharmacological action of the taurine, again, and you don't lose its effect. So you must take taurine irregularly, even if you're taking it for sore eyes, as we mentioned before. Well, where can you get taurine? We've already found out in supplements and baked beef heart, okay? And they still sell beef hearts. Well, does anything lead to the taurine loss that you've got in your body? Yes. Having a heart attack. That works. That'll pull the taurine down. Because what's interesting is that the impulse conduction system is in what we call the subendocardial regions. It's, in other words, just it's shallow in the heart muscle. That is where you get it in the from going from the inside, of course. But so taurine loss, they have found on the inside of the heart muscle where you have your electrical current, that's where the loss is the greatest, and that's where you have your wires that tell you the pump, how to pump and when to pump. Okay? Now, let's look at this. Here we've got something interesting here. You've all heard of tryptophan, or you've heard of fish, for sure. Even though a lot of us don't eat enough of it. Yeah, we don't eat nearly enough fish at all. Well, here's the arrow now. Metabolism of tryptophan leading to taurine, okay? B6, the active form, also helping in this metabolism of this tryptophan or the fish and producing taurine. So obviously, if you have active B6 and you have fish, you can also synthesize taurine. If you have fish and other sulfur amino acids, we didn't need the other there, and sulfur amino acids, which are beans, peas, lentils, onions, that kind of thing. Okay? So it'll help with the synthesis of taurine. But notice this. If you're the hamburger, the French fried, the potato chip group, anything, and you fry bacon in morning, you fry steak at noon, and you refry your potatoes at supper time. And I remember my grandfather coming in. He had 3 ulcers that were bleeding. And he came in the house, and my grandmother, you know, it's funny. He was always quiet, hardly ever said anything. But I'll never forget this as part of my life's experience. My grandfather's in there with his terrible pain. He's bled badly. He comes in and he walks to the stove and he lifts up 3 lids. Fried cabbage. Fried potatoes. Fried something else. And he put it down. It was fried, I think it was fried ham. And he just looked at my grandmother and he said, fried hell. And he walked right out of the kitchen. Guess what? She changed his diet. Nothing was working for her to change the diet. Well, everything the doctor said wouldn't work, but my grandfather's 2 words did. And she never spoke to him for a whole 2 weeks, but anyway, he got his diet changed and his ulcer got a little better. Now, here's what happens. If you have these hot fried things, it comes over here and it absolutely blocks off this B6 activity, which helps in the metabolism of the fish you ate. So instead of getting taurine, you get just a little wee bit of taurine over here, It cuts out the synthesis that you were going to get from the fish you had down here, and you end up with what they call xanthorenic acid, which is a waste product commonly seen in serious heart patients. So what am I saying here? I'm saying whatever you do, cut down on these hot fats like French fries, potato chips, fried hamburgers, fried bacon, fried... It's all right once in a while as a treat, but whatever you do, nowadays the young kids are making this a chronic thing, and we're getting young kids younger and younger and younger with heart attacks. One Christmas, between one Christmas and New Year's, in my practice, I lost 6 patients suddenly from heart attacks. One of them was my wife's uncle, who had a cousin, who had 6 children, and guess how old he was? 24 and a half. He went flat on his face in the living room rug with a cigarette in his mouth, burnt a hole in the rug, and he was DOA when they dead on arrival when they got him to the hospital. Sad situation. But he was a man that was on that other. So remember that. Tend to cut down on fried foods, okay? Now, where heart valves are calcified, and we mentioned that in the past, or otherwise deformed, they produce eddies. Make sense? They're calcified. You don't get a nice smooth flow. You get whirlwinds. Whenever you get an eddy, you've seen rivers, and they have an eddy. Where does the scum collect? In the eddy, not in the main part of the flow. So if you have an eddy of anything that flows in you, and it happens to be where the heart valve is and it's deformed, then an eddy, the clots will form easier there. And unfortunately, the clot can be discharged and enter the brain to produce a stroke. That's what happened to my young son just, what was that, about 6 weeks ago. Fortunately, the lady he was with, he was going, she didn't know what to do because she'd lost her father when he was 43 years of age from a stroke. Didn't lose him because he remained totally unable to do anything in a chair up until he was 70 years of age from the age of 43, I think she said. 43 on. Nothing. He was just a vegetable in a chair for that many years. And then she saw this happening to her boyfriend. She was really upset, and she finds it, oh, maybe I should phone your dad right away. So he did that. So I told her what to do, and by the time they got him to the hospital, although they knew he'd had a stroke, he was coming out of it really well. And boy, if you don't think they've gone over him with a fine-tooth comb, but they discovered that his problem was a deformed valve. He'd formed eddies, then a clot, and the clot had gone right up to the brain. So there's ways in which we can stop that. So problem, calcification of arteries and heart valves. What's the solution? Solution is making sure you have an adequate calcium. Solution. Next slide. Okay. You see, sometimes my talk put people into just really relaxed sleep. Yeah. Okay. I should take up hypnotism, shouldn't I? Okay. Adequate calcium. You need to have that. Next solution. Vitamin D is necessary for calcium absorption, but you don't take too much because it produces spasm. If you get it increases the entrance of calcium into the cells. Okay? If you take too much. So what's too much? Well, we can take a lot more in Canada than they can in southern United States, that's for sure. And I'm not afraid to put people on 800 international units a day. Okay? Very cheap. You can get it in any drugstore, even in London drugs and grocery stores and so on. Little wee dinky capsules, not much bigger than the size of a grain of wheat. Okay, magnesium you need because that's nature's natural calcium blocker, going to prevent that calcium from getting inside of cells where you don't want it. Taurine, which we've told you already, is going to help to maintain your heart rate. Okay, next. Correction of body acidity. Why do I say that? For this reason, if you run a chronic acid state in your body, what happens here is, in order to buffer that state or get it back to neutral, you know, the normal body pH is about 7.36. Let's say 7.4 for ease of remembering. If you remember that 7 is neutral in a pH, below 7 is acid, above 7 is alkali. So if the average healthy body has a 7.4 pH, that means we're alkaline, supposed to be alkali. But the way we eat and the way we act and behave, we have acidic bodies. People with arthritis, diabetes, psoriasis, ulcerative colitis, cancer, you don't, whatever you can name, all have acidic bodies and shouldn't have it. So how do you, what happens then? If your body's acidic, since you need to be alkaline to have good immune system, the body then says, okay, boy, we got to get alkaline. So you get phosphorus pulled out of your skeleton to buffer this acid condition. Of course, phosphorus is pulled out. Calcium follows phosphorus. Phosphorus has got a negative charge, calcium's got positive, so it just follows it right out. So you start pulling calcium out of your bones. And if it pulls, keeps pulling out of your bones and coming out of one special bone, as it comes out, it can form what looks like an icicle in the bottom of your foot, and you call that a heel spur. That's because the calcium's been coming out of the heel bone. And oh, that hurts. And then you do an x-ray of somebody's neck and you say, oh my, they've got, look at these little sharp objects coming out, and like so. And that's, they come out like icicles. And that's telling us that, that person's low on calcium. What is most, a lot of doctors to this day still take you off calcium if they see a heel spur. And the heel spur is there because the calcium's been coming out of the bone. If you had too much calcium, well, it doesn't put the spur in the other way, but that's for sure. Okay? So you've got to correct the body acidity. So there's ways of doing that, and one of the things that they found really helps in correcting that is, to prevent the calcium from coming out of your bones, is yams. And they've done so much research on yams, they can't tell how is it that it's modifying and bringing up body acidity the way, so that it's closer to the normal range. Another thing that helps is apples and applesauce, lemons and limes. And there's a lot of others, but anyway, and more raw vegetables. Red meat, sugar is bad. It tends to acidify us to beat the band. Okay, now I didn't see the last ones. If we could go back there once, go back to the previous slide. Intake of food which, when metabolized, alkalizes. And that's the big thing about that is a lot of people say, well, wait a minute, lemon's acidic. Yes, but when it's metabolized in your body, it's been found it produces an alkalizing condition. It raises the pH of the body rather than lowering. And there you have your yams, lemons, limes, apples, etc. Okay, next. And you have to seriously minimize red meat, sweets, including chocolates. Sorry. Okay? All right. Now, the correction of inflammatory problems. And there's another thing. If you have inflammation, you tend to have calcification wherever you have inflammation. The one thing that's been found to correct inflammatory problems the most significantly, it will surprise you, not aspirin, it's fish oil, EPA and DHA. Don't have to worry about the names, the eicosapentaenoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid. You don't need to worry about those names. But it's fish oil. Fish oil has been found to reduce inflammatory problems such as in rheumatoid arthritis or ulcerative colitis. Just washed my mouth, can't do a thing with it. And by close between 85 and 90%, depending how you set it up. So fish oil definitely helps to prevent some of that calcification on the heart valves and along the blood vessels walls as well. utilizing ionized colloidal silver to fight circulatory infections. Because the body love, if you have eddies on a heart valve and you have a deformed or calcified heart valve, then the infections, bacteria like to set up along the edge of that valve. And that's bad, because that can start throwing off whole bunches of little wee small bits and pieces of infection stuff. And ionized colloidal silver will fight the infections. Now, I must warn you about colloidal silver. Not about all colloidal silver, but about some. If you make colloidal silver with, or it's made with silver wire, or impure silver, you get silver compounds. Silver compounds are carcinogenic. If you make it with pure silver, and then one source for, what's the purest source of silver we can get, that's known in the world? Maple leaf Canadian silver bars. It cost what? Now about, are they $21 now for an ounce of silver? You've got to be kidding. Gross. Boy, the last ones I bought, they were $7. Well, I guess I've made a bit on my three silver bars I've got. Okay, three silver bars. Anyway, if you make your wire out of that, a jeweler can roll that out and you get pure silver, then you will get ionized colloidal silver. Now, ionized colloidal silver, just so you know, has it looks like water, tastes like water. So there's some folks in the States that are giving you water, giving you a bottle about this high and an inch diameter, and charging you $30 for an American. We can get about 35 Canadian here for one about that size. But it's just water. So how do you tell whether you got water, they cheated you, or whether it's really colloidal, ionized colloidal silver? Do you know how you tell? You buy one of these little markers, one of these little things, okay? If you fill a glass full of water and shine this through, you won't see much. But if you do that with colloidal silver, that red beam would go right away through and you'd see this brilliant red beam right all the way through. You know you haven't been cheated then. Okay? Well, that's just one of the things. The other thing, of course, that helps to fight infection is garlic. And echinacea, I would go for the echinacea, okay? Well, little strokes, or TIAs, that's transitory ischemic attacks. That means they're temporary, and it's an attack where you have a sudden low blood supply for a while, okay? Seen now in 30-year-olds. And a Finnish study reported in Lancet. Lancet is the biggest medical journal, classified to be the biggest in the world. Over 50% of these TIAs occurred on a weekend. Interesting. Approximately 20% occurred less than 24 hours after a drinking spree. Okay. And approximately 4% occurred while still drunk. Now, when the rate of intoxication for men and women less than 40 years old was found, for men, intoxication preceded strokes by up to 200%, not just double, 200% more frequently. Okay? That means more frequently than if you weren't a drunk or drinking. And for women, intoxication preceded strokes by up to 300% more frequently. Sorry, ladies. Therefore, female risk is greater than male risk if you're drunk. And of course, women have known that for years. Okay? Right. Well, cerebrovascular disease, that's up to the head here, correlates with the consumption of plant proteins that mimic estrogens, and they're called phytoestrogens, okay, because they're plant form of estrogen. They're mild than the drug, And since soybean and peanuts are high in phytoestrogens, they must be limited where stroke is a danger or if the patient has already had a stroke. Okay? If you see someone, they say, boy, I'm getting dizzy. And every now and again, and it goes away. Or their memory goes for a bit. And they're telling you this. You must take them off of whatever that was, peanuts and soya bean. Okay? Okay. Well, in general, a low stroke incidence is associated with high consumption of fresh vegetables and fruit. And that's again taken from the world's biggest medical journal. Okay? In other words, it's just saying if you're eating lots of fresh vegetables and lots of fresh fruit, and you're eating a lot of them, then you have a low chance of getting a stroke. So vegetarians, it's been found, have a decreased incidence of strokes. You know, that should be, shouldn't that be ENCE? Who's an English major here? Okay, that's twice in that area, okay. Strokes occur for four main reasons. Okay. Small vessel atheroma, what do I mean? That means small vessels with a small clot, okay? Or not a clot, but small hardening of the arteries. Most in the older age group, that equals your TIA, or transitory ischemic attack. Major thrombosis, or clot, that's another cause of a stroke. Rupture of vessels, inducing hemorrhage, or embolism from elsewhere. And that means a clot or malignancy, even an air embolism in scuba divers, okay? One of my colleague, wasn't a colleague really, but I knew of him in the Army. He died from an air embolism because he forgot when he was coming up from the deep end of a 12-foot swimming pool to exhale. And as he came up, of course, the air was expanding. He wasn't exhaling. So bingo, the air went into his blood vessel. And he came up, and it took him 24 hours in the Royal Alec to die. Okay, now, where are we? Stroke. Here's the signs of a TIA. Temporary blindness of one eye, usually. Tingling of the tips of the tongue or lips. Numbness of arm, hand, or leg. An unusual headache. See, I never get a headache. Onset is usually insidious, which the typist put down here, silent, sneaky, and slight. Okay? With decreasing memory. Boy, that should fit me. Emotionally unstable, selfishness, resistance to change. I'm not saying all these fit me. Loss of self-control. Sometimes epilepsy. They sometimes have a seizure, will be one way. And occasionally Parkinson-like tremors. And they go like this, and you say, well, that's funny. And that's a warning, however, that patients having TIAs may become much worse if given an anesthetic. In other words, if you take a patient that's having the signs that we just mentioned, decreasing memory, emotionally unstable, they suddenly got selfish when they weren't, they're resistant to change when they didn't used to be, loss of self-control, they fly off the handle, and sometimes a little bit of epilepsy and they pulled out of it, they rushed them to the hospital, they were out, or occasional Parkinson tremors, and you give them an anesthetic for a major surgery, they sometimes have a stroke patient when the anesthetic is over. Okay? Now, here is a real slide. Are we going to have to, have we got it all? Yeah, I think we do. Okay, here's stroke, and it's a summary of what we've been saying here. Notice this. What causes stroke? First of all, down here, vessel spasm, remember, from calcium getting into cells because someone had way too much vitamin D. So there it is, the arrow, it causes stroke. However, ginkgo, omega-6 fats, and magnesium come down here, bingo, they prevent vessel spasm from causing stroke. Okay? Omega-6, where do you get omega-6? Flaxseed oil is an excellent source, okay? Because you're getting omega-3 with it. Magnesium we've already talked about. Ginkgo increases circulation, so that tends to help they get more blood so you don't get stroke. Also, if you have a bleed in the brain, you can get a stroke from it. Bioflavonoids will tend to stop the bleed from causing the stroke. If you're on bioflavonoids in the first place, you got much less chance of bleeding. They used to call bioflavonoids vitamin P for permeability. And it tightens up the capillaries. They in Germany, they used that for women that were having their periods never seemed to stop. They were always had a little bit of a flow and always having to wear the sanitary napkins over long periods of time. You put them on bioflavonoids, it'll often get rid of it. One of the big things I love bioflavonoids for is this. We know that retinal hemorrhage occurs in diabetics very frequently. And they use a laser beam to fry off the blood vessels. You put them on bioflavonoids and you can stop that back bleeding in the retina in far less than a week. I've done it in dozens of diabetic cases, okay? Well, thrombosis or clot, that'll also produce stroke, but your fish oil will tend to stop that from happening. You won't form the clot in the first place there. So does vitamin B6 in the active form and selenium E, and it will tend to help stop the clot from producing stroke. But what knocks out the B6, you've already heard, was hot fats. But alcohol does much the same. So does junk food does the same. And so does women on estrogen. Well, it'll also tend to stop the beneficial effect of the B6, the selenium and the E. Selenium and E are synergistic. That's why we put them together, okay? Well, the other beneficial effect of hot fats even comes up here and blocks off the beneficial effect of B6 going up this way as well. It doesn't block off the selenium E as much. I don't think it blocks it off at all, really. But the B6 goes up here. Bingo, it gets stopped at the pass because it would have normally produced cystathione, which is non-toxic to arteries. So going over here again, you find that alcohol by itself will produce a stroke. Binging is one of the things that will induce a stroke. Okay? So will homocysteine, which is toxic to arteries. And you'll notice that lecithin, which is very high in phosphorus, so if you're taking lecithin, never forget to take your calcium magnesium, okay, to balance that off. And you get choline from lecithin, and plus oxygen, bingo, then, and, you know, unfortunately, we get most of our oxygen from breathing heavy. And of course, you could think of a number of things, but we usually think of exercise in front of crowds, okay? Yeah. And then choline will decrease this homocysteine, which is toxic to arteries and can result in a stroke. And so does vitamin B12. And they have now, instead of getting shots with B12, you can get drops. You put under the tongue. As long as you put under the tongue and it gets the same effect, you don't have to go to the doctor and get a needle. And for the average person, you would put maybe 3 to 4 drops under your tongue 5 out of 7 days a week. And that would do the thing, okay? So here now we have folic acid, here's homocysteine, methionine, they tend to go this way. If you're taking your active form of B6, we call that pyridoxal 5-phosphate. You can get that in a supplement form. You take that, it'll change this homocysteine and push it down this way to methionine, which is non-toxic to arteries and it doesn't lead to stroke. And folic acid tends to do that as well, which is good. Unfortunately, heat, again, estrogen, women that are on the pill and taking sulfa drugs will tend to block off folic acid. So, if you're, if you're a hot soul, but if you're cooking with a lot of heat, you're on the estrogen pill, and you take sulfa drugs, you better be sure and boost this up quite a bit, okay? Your folic acid. And never take a B by itself because they're synergistic, okay? takes a while to produce those silly little curves there. Next. Okay, this is an interesting one here. I remember Spanish films that I saw, beautifully done, and where they had cameras showing what went on in blood vessels. And what happened here is you have what they call the intima, or the lining of a blood vessel, the artery, and a cell would fly off and head down this way, say the blood was flowing this way. And when a cell held off that way, then a platelet or a blood clotting cell would come along and it would set itself right over where the hole was, where the intimal cell lining cell had disappeared, or a couple of them would tear off. So it went on there, and it looked like a ghost. It looked like a ghosty octopus, and it would go over the top. Then after a while, you would see more ghosts of these platelets building up here. Also, artery would come. Then you'd see macrophages, and they'd come along and say, oh boy, something's going on here. And these things are what they call the big eaters. They'd get in there. Then you'd notice after a while, slowly, it took days, but after a while, you see a little calcium come here. So you'd end up with plaque, a fibrous cap. When you had the plaque building up like this, then this muscle wall cell here, these cells started to grow in and push this plaque up and up and up until you got it way like that. It was most intriguing watching these films. Okay, so this is what happens. So in the previous pictures, it should be noted that blood fats stick to the plaque. They're covered by platelets, etc., with calcium and fat and clotting cells plus scar tissue cells plus calcium all mixed together, and that's what you call hardening of the arteries, okay? Well, have you ever wondered why there's cholesterol stuck to the inside of arteries and not on the inside of veins? You don't find that kind of buildup inside of veins. The reason is that chronic inflammation, this is the reason, it's the chronic inflammation of the arterial walls. And cholesterol, I've been trying to say this for years, and finally, we've got it now in the New England Journal of Medicine, 1999, an article by Dr. Ross, and that the cholesterol comes to soothe the inflammation. Cholesterol is not the problem. It's attempting to be the solution, okay? You've got an inflammation of the arterial walls. The arteries have muscles, and the muscle walls are inflamed. And the cholesterol is coming in an attempt to soothe this inflammation. It's like saying that you had a car accident with a whole, and every time I see a real bad car accident, I see two things, ambulances and police cars. Obviously, the cause of the problem is those ambulances and the police cars, because they're the common factor when they've ignored the other one. They're coming there, hopefully, to try and solve the problem. But this is the problem. And how do you get rid of the chronic inflammation? By eating right. We already talked about that you must eat more raw fruits and vegetables, sugar, fried foods. Red meats, an awful lot of red meats, will produce that inflammation. Okay? Now, the fat that got mixed in the clot, what have we got here? We've got that from 60 to 75% of cholesterol is the so-called bad stuff, the LDL, low-density lipoprotein. They call it that way because it has very little protein mixed with the fat compound. About 20 to 25% is the so-called good HDL, or high-density lipoprotein. It's high density because it's got more protein than fat in the molecule, okay? Next. Oh, the bad is only bad if there's too much there, because you do need some fat for your hormones. I think everybody went to sleep. High-density lipoprotein's function is to remove excess cholesterol from the tissues. Okay? and this is the one. They have a family of high-density lipoproteins now, but this is the big one here that's responsible for the decrease of atherosclerotic risk. You've heard that good cholesterol tends to clean out the bad stuff. Well, this is the one. It's a family member called HDL2, okay? And I might say, when it comes to the decrease of atherosclerotic risk, selenium E. I just heard on the radio day before yesterday, a doctor on, I think it was on CHED, and he's your doctor's on-call kind of program, and here he was saying that he'd never seen any research that showed that vitamin E, or with or without selenium, would do this. And I just shake my head, because if you went on the internet and you tried to find out all of the advantages of vitamin E, and you went on tonight, and you weren't going to get off that chair until you're finished, what month is this? This is February. Yeah, it would be well into summer before you got off your chair. I remember going to a big seminar filled. We had 75 doctors there. And I remember the man, they flew him in, and he said to the audience, he said, does a single person here know any advantage to taking vitamin E? My hand went up. He said, oh yes, Dr. Taylor. And I said, well, just you only asked for a single, so I won't take all your time away. But I said, it's rather interesting that if you don't have vitamin E, the astronauts found that the red blood cells broke down on their trips to the moon and back. So they have to, now, if the astronaut does not take vitamin E, they're not allowed to leave the Earth. So they don't fly. Okay? Well, now notice the increased level and duration of broad-spectrum vitamin E, because typical of everybody, they're trying to make a synthetic stuff out of everything that should be good because they can sell a synthetic. The usual standard here they use is a DL, which is synthetic. And this was some work done by Horwitt and his group, and it's in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And this is, you know, people still don't know this, but he gave 800 international units of vitamin E here to a group of adult volunteers. Then he took their blood levels at 8, 24, and 48 hours afterwards. Look at what he found. And this is the milligrams per deciliter readings here. He took the usual standard, which was the DL, the synthetics. Incidentally, the acetate is the liquid form, and the succinate is the powdered form, okay? So what he did here was he gives them, and this is where their blood levels measured. Oh, looks real good. Then he gave them some not synthetic stuff, but he gave them some from wheat germ. Bingo. Same dose, 800 international units, and here it was here, okay? Now he added pectin to that liquid vitamin E, and sure enough, he found that pectin produced synergism, especially in the 24 hours. Same dose of E, but with the pectin, he got much higher blood levels, especially at 8 hours. Once it was down to about 24 hours, there wasn't that much difference. Then he took the broad spectrum E. This has had everything in it. Look at what happened. It went up, way up to here, there, and there. That's broad spectrum E. So that if you were taking one of these every 48 hours, you can notice coming across here that you'd still have a higher blood level than taking the synthetic stuff every single day. Okay? So there's an advantage to broad-spectrum stuff, food-based supplements, okay? Now, problem, low, high density. You want that up, you don't want it low. What's the solution? Regular exercise, horse, okay? Next, lower fat intake. Next, more regular exercise, more horrors, okay? Next, a little red wine, one small drink per day has been found highly effective. Next, avoiding sweets, raisins and grapes, because the sugar in raisins and grapes is different than the sugar in your other fruits, okay? It's glucose, okay? Paralyzes your white blood cells, so on. Increase high complex carbohydrates, chromium. And you want to have glucose tolerance factor chromium. It works. And the one you want for that is whole wheat bread. Okay? You don't get it out of white stuff. You have to correct, next slide, H. You have to correct copper deficiency, if you've got it. Take carnitine, which is another amino acid that's found to help heart muscle tremendously, and increase your fish oil. Okay? If you wanted to get fish oil without supplements, you've got to eat fish at minimum of 4 times a week, 4 full meals. Okay? Now, if vegetable oils are high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, which most of them are, and they're only at 10% of your caloric intake, every time you see a bunny, I'm known for bunny trails. So this is one of my bunny trails. But if you had 10% of this, like if you had margarine and you only had 10% of the caloric intake, remembering that it's 9 calories per gram of fat, where it's only 4 for protein or carbohydrates, then you take it 10%, early aging, especially of facial skin, occurs. Okay? So I'm one of these that likes to see you ladies stay as looking as young as possible, as long as possible. That's what happens from being an incurable romantic, I guess. Okay, well, next. Problem, increased total cholesterol, okay? Well, the solution is lower fat foods, less meat, more veg. Don't use bread as an edible plate to hold all that nice fat. Vitamin B3 in the form of niacinamide, it'll prevent flushing and you can go up to a much higher dose. Incidentally, that stuff is really, they're really interested in this B and the Benjamin Institute in the States because it's been found to reverse cancer of the bone. Okay? And the inositol with the niacin here prevents flushing, and you can take 500 milligrams of B3. Never take this without taking other Bs because all Bs are synergistic. And again, you need chromium, whole wheat bread for glucose tolerance factor chromium. Yeast is the biggest source, but that's a good one. Psyllium, 3 teaspoons per day because of the high fiber. This is lowering total cholesterol, of course. Okay? Low alcohol, frequent small meals, low sugar, limit raisins and grapes, and you should also be diluting your fruit juices 50-50 with water. Ginkgo biloba again, and garlic, which is good. Now, the ginkgo and the garlic take usually about 2 months or 8 weeks to take effect in lowering total cholesterol. A lot of doctors are telling us that that doesn't work. And there's some of the references that you can apply to just what I've finished saying. Now, here's something. The problem, chlorinated water. This is a very significant factor, and which we should know about. And maybe when I'm finished this, we could come very close. Did I get the 5 sign yet? No, okay. Very close to a short break. There was a doctor by the name of Dr. Price. He was asked to go and help a friend of his remove some dairy piping. Dairy piping is quite an interesting piece of piping. And the pipes were getting, they get what they call milk stone in them. And they've never found a good way of getting milk stone out, so you want to do preventative. And it milk stone will form on the rubber pieces, it'll form in the pipelines. So there he was helping his friend, and they took it off. And remember, the dairy farmer looks down the pipe and he says, "Oh boy, I hope my arteries are a lot better than these." And the doctor twigged. And he says, "That's interesting." He had heard that and knew that hardening of the arteries in roosters, not in hens, but in roosters, was similar to the hardening of arteries in human beings. And he said, "Well, I wonder if there's something flowing through our blood vessels that's producing this kind of hardening in our pipes." So he decided he was going to find out. He got 200 chickens, roosters. You can imagine when the dawn came up in the morning, 200 of them crowing. Boy, I don't think he slept in too many mornings there. But anyway, he got them. He divided them up in two, and they had open pens to run around in, open pens here. And what he did was, they both had identical food, identical situation. They had free choice. They could go and eat whenever they wanted. And there they were, roughly all the same age. He put the same water, but in one, he had the water chlorinated at the same level as it is in the city. In the other one, same water, but no chlorine. What did he notice? In 3 weeks, he noticed, hey, the combs are getting kind of pale in the ones on the chlorinated side, in my 100 over here. That's interesting. And he noticed that they were starting to look tired. They started to spend their time up against the sheltered walls instead of coming out to eat. They only came to drink and to eat and then go back. And inside of approximately 6 to 8 weeks, the chickens that were on the chlorinated water looked like they'd been dipped in water and blow-dried from behind. They were all fluffy and irregular. And they just kind of scratched their heads, and they're wondering. So then, after around 2 months or so, he decided they're going to sacrifice a few. So they sacrificed a few of the ones that were on the chlorinated water, a few of the ones that the water was not chlorinated. They found the ones that not perfect chickens, no problem. Their combs were brilliant red. They were up. They were healthy, active, and so on. The others, he found out they had hemorrhage in the lungs and they had quite serious atherosclerosis. By 7 months, almost all of the, he'd lost over 3/4 of the other chickens that were on the chlorinated water and none of the ones that were on the non-chlorinated water. So then they decided to sacrifice all of them, and they sacrificed a good slug of the good ones, and they discovered that the good ones also had a little wee bit of hardening of the arteries, very little, but these others, it was massive. And so he published that, or at least he wrote it up, and he took it to some medical journals. His only reply was, well, we can't publish this. Why not? Well, it's just not confirmed. Oh. So he got two other doctors who also had enough land to buy 200 roosters, and they went through the same thing, and they got exactly the same result. Now he was really happy. Everyone was going to publish this, and they were going to find out that chlorinated water was really bad for producing atherosclerosis in roosters, male roosters, who they had found out years ago and still do know that the rooster produces atherosclerosis of his blood vessels much the same as a human does. No one would publish his data, and they didn't give him any reason. His book is out of print. I have one, and in reading it over, poor Dr. Price, he was really upset that no one would ever listen to him. So the solution, one of the major solutions to atherosclerotic disease, is to get off of your chlorinated water. All right? Well, let's see if you had an increased low-density lipoprotein, the one that's supposed to help clog you up. The solution, get off of chlorinated water. That's one. Another solution is oatmeal daily. It's effective in approximately 10 days. It is not effective if you do it in the medical journals that and it's been in a number of them, where they take university students who do not have a high LDL in the first place and give them oat bran. It will not lower a normal LDL level below normal. It will lower a very high one, okay? So oat bran also greatly increases bile excretions by 54%, therefore using up stored cholesterol. And the way it does that, it takes cholesterol and your fat-soluble vitamins plus the active form of B6 in order to make bile acid. So if you're taking vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin K, where's vitamin K high in? High in horseradish, and broccoli with the leaf. It's very high in there as well. So what you do if you're taking that and you're taking your B6, then those things all lined up, more cholesterol is being used to make bile acid. So it's pulling your cholesterol down in order to make bile acid if you take those, okay? Now, this usually requires, for oat bran, usually requires a large bowl of the cereal and 4 muffins per day. Now, pinto and navy beans leads to a rapid decrease of LDL, so those are good if you can stand the gas. And if your friends can stand the gas, okay? We have a saying in our house, better in than out. Or what is that one they used to say in Scotland, honey? No, yeah, better. Oh, yeah, better out than in. But what was the other one? Something about a bad tenant. It's an old Scottish, someone can tell me about that later. It's an old Scottish thing, getting rid of a bad tenant, okay? Better to suffer the pain, the pain of the embarrassment than to hang on to the bad tenant or something. That was a Scotch saying. Okay, activated charcoal for rapid decrease of LDL, the bad cholesterol, so-called. A half a tablespoon a day times 4 weeks has lowered LDL by 41%. For those of you who had bad cholesterol, that's the one that's usually considered bad. Okay? Charcoal particles attract other substances as well as fat globules. They will attract gas bubbles and is therefore used to decrease flatulence. And speaking of that subject, speaking of flatulence, the average adult has 14 episodes per day. Now, I don't know who, I've got the reference for this, but can you imagine being that's what you're studying? How many times per day was the adult going to have an episode? So there's one of my bunny trails, and that's Bunny there, just grinning at you, saying, yeah, okay. So, okay. Well, atherosclerosis continued. Mineral supplement is necessary when on charcoal as the latter pulls the minerals out. Charcoal pulls your minerals out. Much lower sweets. Stop your coffee, tea, chocolate, and Coke because of the sugar, for one thing, and the caffeine because it's pulling calcium out of your bones and raising the calcium levels in your bloodstream. Increase your fish intake. Avoid hydrogenated oils. And a high fiber intake. And we're just about ready for... Okay, next one shows the references. After this, a partially blocked artery. Look at this. Taken out of a human being, and there you have what's a little wee bit left here. This is a blood vessel wall way out here, down here, way out here. And here you've got what's left. This blood vessel's already got a clot in it. Here was this. Obviously, this vessel isn't in the human anymore, but he died, and there's the little wee bit of blood he was able to get through there. Okay, let's just finish strokes, and then we'll go to blood pressure. Homocysteine, this is the stuff that's bad. It helps to produce atherosclerosis, but you want to, methionine will come up here and tend to stop that from doing that. Here's your P5P, that's active B6. Hot fats cutting it off. Here's B12 and folic acid coming down here, helping this movement here. Enzymes, which you need in everything in the body. Fluoride and increased salt. Salt's an anti-enzyme. That's why a lot of people pickle with it. Fluoride is the strongest anti-enzyme other than acid or fire, and it'll knock out enzymes greatly and very easily, and it'll stop the production of methionine, stops this block here, so then homocysteine has a freewheeling over here to produce hardening of the arteries. Next one. Here is O2, oxygen, increased oxygen, hot foods, egg yolk powder, powdered milk, fried foods, all produce oxysterols, they're called. And that by itself can produce atheroma or these plaques we were talking about, which can lead to cardiovascular disease and stroke. And here is methionine and homocysteine. Homocysteine also produces oxysterols and it comes back here, but it can directly be involved in atheroma. And what happens here, methionine, which you get from a little bit of red meat, fish, and some dairy products. But B6 tends to bring this homocysteine back over in this direction. Okay, that's why it's sloped that way. Next, but, notice this, but you add folic acid, B2, B12, B6, then you're going to get a movement this way to the methionine, and instead of producing many oxysterols from homocysteine directly and oxysterols indirectly, you're not going to get as much atheroma and therefore less cardiovascular disease and stroke. Okay? Let's have a break there.
Thank you, Dr.
Okay. Is this too deep? Someone's been telling me that it's maybe too deep for some people. Is this way too deep, or are you getting anything out of it? Last time we went over decreasing cardiovascular disease and stroke from the point of view of decreasing the atheroma or the clot or the hardening of the arteries rather by eating more fish, taking your B6, and of course now and getting folic acid B2, B12, which you can take under the tongue now. And you have to keep it in the fridge, shake the bottle, because it tends to settle in the bottom. Thanks, Monica.
Excuse me, does someone borrow a pen from
there? You need a pen? Okay. That could be it. Okay. So that's where we were. Now, next. Okay, problem, vasospasm and increased blood pressure. And this is just a diagrammatic, there's your blood vessel, and here, boy, it's in vasospasm. Tends to occur in the younger adult, to get this, when they have a heart attack, and of course those with high blood pressure. And this is going to really blow your mind a wee bit. And okay, I want a free wheel on this one if I can. The body's arteries are not rigid pipes. They are pipes that enlarge and contract, okay? And when we eat, for example, more blood goes to the digestive area, the arteries there will dilate and you get more blood so that it'll speed up digestion. Now, my question is this. What happens if the blood vessels dilate around your digestive area, okay? Where does that come from? Has to come from the other blood vessels. How can it come from the other blood vessels if they're rigid? It can't. So it contracts where? Almost invariably in your arms, your legs, and your muscles. So because we don't have a water storage thing other than our bladder, and of course that's not available for our circulation, okay? We wish it was in the middle of the night all the time, but it isn't. So since we don't have a water storage area, other vessels must constrict in order to provide the blood somewhere else. And this caliber variation is under complex neurochemical and physiological control. We won't go into all of the science behind all of this because it gets deep, but I'll give you the basics so that you'll enjoy the understanding. Okay? The body has priorities for the control. The number one priority is the brain, okay? The brain must not become dehydrated, and I guess we should be able to figure that out. So when it senses that our bodies are a bit on the dehydrated side, what does the brain do? It sends a message down to the body, but before we do that, what's the number two priorities? Lung, kidney, liver, and glands. And finally, bones, muscles, and skin. And here is the big one right here. The muscles, although it's not a priority, it is a priority. The blood vessels there, or the arteries there, are a priority in order to provide the flow to the brain. Now, most of us do not drink enough water. Besides that, the water we drink is not the best kind. You don't want chlorinated water, and you don't want fluoridated water. But what happens is the body when the brain, which is the top priority, senses body dehydration. And you know why? How you can tell you're dehydrated? A lot of us can't anymore. We only use thirst as a thing. Did you know that the boys down in the States have done the research, and if your body, they have found out, well, how much is the right amount of water for us? They discovered that the curve is like a sugar dome. And we should be right at the top for maximum efficiency, because all nutrition is fluid-borne into cells and all waste products is fluid-borne out. And they found the maximum efficiency occurs if we're on the top of this curve. If we're over the edge and we're drinking far too much water, we're making things boggy, and when the nutrition tries to get into cells, the waste is trying to come out, and the good stuff mixes with the bad stuff, and so instead of a nice little rivulet into the cell, you've got a swamp. And so that doesn't work out too well. So the big thing here is that because we are chronically dehydrated, they figured out, well, how much water do we need to get on the peak? And what they've discovered is this: your weight in pounds divided by 2 is the ounces of good water you need every 24 hours. Now, the problem with that formula is if you have congestive heart failure and you're storing a lot of water on your ankles or your heart is enlarged, you have to approach this then slowly over a number of weeks. If you don't, you can be an overload for your heart. So we don't want to overload the heart. Well, how does the body, the brain, tell the muscles to contract so that it can solve this dehydration problem? And incidentally, before I mention that, when you do drink that amount of water per 24 hours, guess what, folks? It takes 3 months for your body to be adequately hydrated. 3 whole months. The first 3 days, you'd swear that you're going to the washroom so often, I must be fully hydrated. You're not. You're not anywhere near it. Okay? So, how does the body tell the arteries to contract and hold on to water when you're dehydrated? It does this by a mechanism that promotes a compound called angiotensin. What is angiotensin? Angio, that's a blood vessel word. Tension means tension, contract. Okay? Good enough for that. So the body also is told to hang on to all salt that you've got. So what happens? Because salt holds onto water. Now notice this. Those of you know that salt is sodium chloride. Here's the sodium with a positive charge, and it's a pretty strong ion. Here's oxygen. There's the O. It's got 2 hydrogens. There's 1 positive charge, oxygen, 2 negative charges. Because opposite charges repel one another, wherever these positive charges are on the side of the oxygen, these 2 negative charges want to be over here. But, so that means there's a negative charge here, when sodium has a potassium, has a positive charge, so these two like to hold together. So wherever sodium goes, water follows. This H2O follows it, okay? So therefore, the body tells the brain tells the body, hang on to sodium, because if you hang on to your sodium will hang on to water, because I'm dehydrated. So what does the body do? So when the brain needs water, the message is sent to the arteries, contract and force more water to go to my brain, to me. That's the new physiology that's not known. Now notice this. When the doctor now does your blood pressure when you're dehydrated, what does he find? He finds it elevated, of course, because it's contracted down. It's contracted down in an effort to build the pressure up to make sure that your brain is adequately hydrated. So what does doc do? He or she, whoever they are, puts you on a water pill, because he forgets that the pipes are not rigid pipes. And if you have rigid pipes and the pressure's too high in a rigid pipe system, what do? You bleed off some of the fluid that's in the pipe, and down comes the pressure. So he gives you a diuretic, helps to make you pee, as is indicated, for removing the water and the salt from the imagined rigid pipes. Now, because the you flow out more water as a result, it kind of catches the blood vessels by surprise, and your blood pressure goes down. The brain suddenly gets the message, well, you know, something's gone wrong. And so it tells those arteries, you contract more. I didn't get the fluid I wanted. It was getting it while you had the pressure in the pipes when it was contracting. Now it says you contract more. So what does the doctor do? After 3 months, this person goes back and says, you know, I'm not feeling too good. So the doctor gives you a second pill for decreasing your blood pressure. After another 5 months or so, he gives you the third pill to decrease your blood pressure. By the time a year or a little more has gone over, a year and a half, you're on a fourth one. Now it's starting to affect things. And so you get a whole bunch of other drugs to go on to correct the effects that these other drugs have done. So next. So incidentally, when any person is chronically dehydrated, they're producing much more histamine. This is one of my little bunny trails, as you can see, okay? And what does that mean? If you're chronically dehydrated, you've got a history of much more histamine, and you should have antihistamine if you have any tendency for allergies. So if you've got allergies and you're dehydrated, you're going to get in more problems. And increased histamine leads to susceptibility to allergies, so you cannot smell the roses, or any other flower for that matter. So that's another one of my little bunny trails, okay? So I've been known for bunny trails. When I was a young man, my first name is Carlton, my last was Taylor, and I was a little wee tow-headed blonde like this, and the neighbors would just say, what's your name, little fella? And the closest I could get to it was Cottontail. So I got Cottontail by all the neighbors around, okay? So the first treatment for hypertension is water, not a diuretic. The second thing is you don't cut down your salt unless you're salt sensitive. Now, some people are salt sensitive, hypertensive. This means their pressure will rise as their sodium intake goes up. Okay? And a lot of others are not salt. There's a smaller group that are salt sensitive that are not salt sensitive. That makes sense? So what's the solution to solve salt sensitivity? It's been found to be calcium particularly, but don't take it without magnesium. That you don't want the calcium in the cells producing spasm, which can produce more high blood pressure, so you take CalMag, and I was just going to show you the reference down under there. Okay? And that reference, you'll notice, has been found in the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and it was a lecture I attended by the researcher, Dr. Zemel, in February, which is this month of 2002. And this is good. I'm glad that they have found this out. It's a lot later, you know, some of us knew it, very few of us knew it before, but this is what we've been wanting to do. I've had taken people off of high blood pressure, they've had terrible high blood pressure, and they've been called malignant hypertensives, meaning that it was malignant, nothing we could do. And I've had them fall down, break their arms, this is when they went to the specialist after and got on all these drugs, fall down, break their arms on the icy roads and curbs and so on, come in, and we've ventured, and they're so terrified. I remember one man so terrified to tell a specialist he'd gone off of all of these 6 medications he had for his malignant hypertension. I got his blood pressure down from 200 and I think it was 35 over 155. I got it down to 140 over, I think it was 85. But he took one of his 6 medications once a week so he could tell the doctor, yes, I'm still taking my medications. Bless his heart. Matter of fact, he married my wife and I 50 and a half years ago. Okay? Now, what was this solution to? Hypertension. Okay. All right. What's the solution? Careful water intake in case you have chronic high blood pressure. Incidentally, if you're normal, you don't have an enlarged heart, you don't have ankle swelling a lot, and it's a hot day and you're sweating, you can take more water, okay? Never less. Okay, PGE1, what's that stuff? Well, that's prostaglandin E1. It's an essential fatty acid that produces anti-inflammatory problems, so you don't get more spasm in the artery, and it's from evening primrose or other sources such as wheat germ. You must decrease prostaglandin E2 precursors. What? Because this stuff fights that good stuff. This is the bad stuff if you have too much of it. And what are the precursors? Hot fats, your potato chips, french fries, hamburgers. Okay? Do you know that nowadays some of these high school kids and university kids too, and college students, that they eat french fries and potato chips all day long, every day? It's gotten to be a big thing for them. Avoid dairy. Dairy is one of the things that increases this one that fights the good stuff. You no red meat. This is, of course, if you're really in bad shape. No organ meats. We weren't meant to eat liver and steak and kidney pie, such as they have in England, as much as I love it. No crustaceans. You know what crustaceans are? Shrimp, clams, oysters, lobster, and so on. Part of the reason for this is that these characters here, they're bottom feeders. Where do heavy metals settle when they get to the ocean? On the bottom. Heavy metals knock out our enzyme systems, and we can't breathe, we can't see, hear, heartbeat, digest, anything if our enzymes are knocked out. So you don't want to knock them out, because heavy metals knock enzymes out easily. Niacetol, again, as I say before, Benjamin Institute really excited about that stuff because it's good for fighting cancer of the bone. Avoid a high vitamin D to prevent calcium entry into cells and therefore spasm, which you don't want. Next. Now look at this. This is rather interesting when he said no red meat. If you'll notice here, this was vegetarians in here, all of them. And then what they did, and this is the weeks of study down here, and then these vegetarians, this is their blood pressure. Of course, it's always high when you first go to see the doctor the first time. After you get used to the character, then it's dropping, okay? But then they put them on meat. And notice this. Boop, 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 boop. This is an average blood pressure pill. There goes the blood pressure way up over here. And then finally here they said, now we want you to go off of meat, please. And vegetarians, no problem. So they went off meat, and here was their blood pressure again. I hadn't finished with that last one. If we could just go back there a second. Vegetarians, okay, we told you that. And that was in the Journal of American Medical Association back in 1991. And this is part of the reason we say minimize your red meat. You need at least one piece of it a week for your alpha-ketoglutarates. And do you know what those are? Alpha-ketoglutarates are necessary for you to get into the energy cycle, so you'll get some energy. Okay, next. Okay, now, wait a minute. Back to that other one. Notice this. This is your heart, and this is your hypothalamus in the brain with the spinal cord coming down here. Your cerebral cortex, the outer shell of your brain, and of course here you've got the kidney and the adrenal gland and blood vessels here. Now, what I'm showing you this is, in place of the things that I've told you that will lower blood pressure nutritionally without bad side effects, notice this. Here's what the doctors will generally put you on in terms of drugs. Phenobarbital, meprobamate, Rauwolfia, hydralazine, iproniazid, Rauwolfia again, Veratrum, hydralazine again, hexamethonium, linium, and all of these others. This is a very common one here, all of these, and this is only part of the blood pressure medications that they give. They usually start with this one, and then they'll often go to this one, then they go to this one, and then they start going up this table here, and this is only part of them. I couldn't put them all in. Interesting. And yet I've been able to take people off of that over the years. And they don't have, they love it because they don't have any bad sex now. Now they don't stumble, they're not sitting in the chair like a zombie, and their wives and their relatives are rather glad because they're getting out and going for a walk now. Okay, next. Here's a problem. Rulo. These are red blood cells here. Okay? And like rulo means that the red blood cells have stuck together like poker chips coated with honey before you poured them out on the table. Well, of course, they'd stick together. And when they stick together like this, those red cells are going to form clots, and they're going to be too big a clump to go through a small blood vessel. Do you know that with proper water intake and proper selenium E for the membranes on those, that in order for, how does a red blood cell this big, let's say we've enlarged it till it's this big, get through a pipe this small? Has to have flex, has to be flexible. What it does, it twists into a figure eight. It's like taking an inner tube, twist it to a figure eight, suddenly the diameter is way down and the figure eight can go through. And that's what they do, but they will not do it if the cell is rigid. It tends to get rigid with age, or if we're not on enough selenium E, okay? So, proper water intake is the solution for that. You need to have more water. And niacin, the vitamin B3, but never take a B all by itself because all Bs are synergistic. So you take niacin. What does niacin do? It's rather interesting. We've got the B complex for niacin synergism, but niacin then puts a negative charge on each one of these cells. Now, on the membrane, which is supposed to have. And negatives repel one another, so now the cells, instead of being clumped together, are spread apart, okay? So, here's another problem. Platelet aggregation. Platelets are your clotting cells. And if you have clotting cells, and they're in little bunches like these, that's bad. Because again, that can plug small blood vessels. What you want is the platelets separated this way. That's the good. Now, how do we do that? Here's the solution to that problem. Fish oils, they work on membranes. Evening primrose oil has been found to help solve rulo. Or I'm sorry, platelet aggregation sticking together. Vitamin C does it somewhat, and fermented garlic does it. Okay? Active B6, but not if the aggregation or the clumping is caused by epinephrine, and you know that's the stuff from the from your adrenaline glands that comes up if you're frightened. So if you're chronically anxious and chronically fearful, then you'll find that active B6 will not work, because that's caused clumping a different, or if the clumping is caused by arachidonic acid, which is a precursor to the bad PGE2 that we add. Okay? Now, here's another problem. Now, this problem tends to occur in younger people when the younger person, I'm talking younger people, someone in their 40s, 30s, 50s, 60s, when they get heart attacks, all right? Now, what happens here is that we normally have fibrinogen. That means generates fibrin. This is a liquid, but it's a liquid fiber that's in our bloodstreams that tends to only become a real fiber or thread when we're cut and our blood's exposed to the air. Okay? So if it's exposed to the air, then this what is liquid unseen fiber, your smiling face here, then as we age, these tend to increase tremendously. And this isn't so smiley and isn't so happy about it, because these fibers then can start forming a clot just because we start to exercise a bit without knowing that our fibrinogen levels were high and there's enough oxygen that we're breathing in now, we start to form clots in our blood vessels without being cut. So bingo, that's not so good. So what we want to do, the solution is to get out of this and get back to where we were when we were 16 years of age. Well, what's the solution? Garlic is the most effective by far, and particularly the fermented garlic, okay? Another solution, magnesium also helps to bring you back. And it'll bring you these and vitamin C. And is there another one? And adequate water intake again. Those four will tend to work rather rapidly on people with high fibrinogen. Protects them from getting a second heart attack. It's really intriguing that you could do that rather than going on the drug that does it, which causes some very bad side effects, okay? Now, here's what's going to blow your mind. Maybe it blew mine. Angiograms are used as a basis for indicating the need for surgery. And I'm going to find this on here. Page 21. Wonderful. Thank you. Okay. Twice as many bypasses are done in Winnipeg than in Brandon, Ontario, but they both have the same death rate after surgery in both cities, so in the cities. So there's no difference. Even though they do twice as many in Winnipeg as they do in Brandon, the same death rate occurs in both, so something's wrong. The bypasses weren't doing what they're supposed to do, okay? Brandon, Ontario. Yeah. Canadians get 5 times as many bypasses per capita as Americans do, but the latter, or the Americans, do 10 times those done in England. Now, can you do some multiplication and tell me how many bypasses per capita are done in Canada compared to in England? You're right. Okay? In the United States, cardiovascular death rate is 77% higher in males than in females. So men receive more angioplasties. Do you know what an angioplasty is? It's when they put a tube down and it's got a balloon on the end of the tube and they can put the tube down in and run it through the artery and say, oh, it's narrow here. So then they get it in the right spot and they pump up the air and they spread it apart, hoping that it won't rupture the blood vessels as the balloon goes up. Okay? That's an angioplasty. So men receive more angioplasties, and angioplasty cardiologists in the U.S. can make $2,000 an hour, and that's U.S. funds. How would you like to have that job and do about 5 a day? No wonder they can afford Cadillacs and whatever else, okay? So compare what that amount of money brings in to what he or she would get for advising exercise, lifestyle change, and dietary advice, etc., when all of those get better results, if you look at the research. 10-year, now look at this, folks, a 10-year study, $24 million of U.S. funds for this study, conducted by the National Lung and Heart Institute, screened 16,000 patients, all with unrelenting angina. In other words, they had chest pain. I got to stop doing that. That always reminds me of my mom. My mom was very wise person. When she was in the ICU with a heart monitor on, she'd say, nurse, nurse, nurse. No one would come. She needed to go to the washroom. So what she would do is she'd go on that, and it would make a great noise, and it would upset the ECG curve, and suddenly 4 nurses would rush to the bed. I need a bedpan, please. Yeah, I used to laugh at that, and they would just say, oh my, don't do that, it upsets. Well, she said, I already called out, and I've been calling for 15 minutes, and she said, I don't like lying in a wet bed. So anyway, so here it was, screened 16,000 patients, all with unrelenting angina or chest pain from lack of oxygen to the heart muscle, so it's going into spasm and it hurts, who had bypasses at 11 leading medical centers. Now notice this. These patients, 16,000, that had bypasses. All right, now let's look. Results, when compared to a matched group of patients not having a bypass, there was no death rate difference in those who did not have the surgery. Now what do you think of that? $24 million U.S., and they've done bypasses on 16,000. They compare another 16,000 who did not have bypasses, but who also had unrelenting angina, and the death rate is the same. Now, I don't know about you, but if I knew the death rate was going to be the same if I had angina, whether I had the operation or not, I wouldn't want someone going in there and splitting my breastbone in two and opening my chest up like a book. Because I think I'm a coward and I think it hurts. So I wouldn't want to do it, okay? Now, for over 30 years, coronary angiograms, that's where they put the tube up in the artery in your groin and up there, and they put a dye in and they do the coronary angiograms. They've been the test relied on for the need of a bypass, okay? The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute conducted a three-phase study. Let's see what they found on this study. Phase one, arteriographers working independently, these are the guys that read these x-rays, looked at films of 28 patients who had died within 40 days of having their heart catheterized for doing the angiograms, okay? Next slide. When their readings were compared with post-mortem findings, remember those 28 died, and they can on post-mortem, it's easy to tell how the arteries are. You just cut them open and have a look. But when they did the arteriograms, the findings, the arteriographers were wrong more than 50% of the time. So if you're told, uh-oh, you've got bad arteries, you're going to have a cardiac bypass. My first question I would ask, oh? Well, since the audiogram, or since the, arteriography is wrong at least once out of twice, how do we know? Well, who told you it was at least that, you know, once out of twice? That's ridiculous. Our men are experienced. Okay, let's go on. 82% of the experts' estimations were significantly over or underestimated. Okay? These experts were very experienced x-ray readers, far more than you can find in Canada. Next. In phase two, 30 films showing distinct pathology were sent to three first-rate centers to discover how often first, second, and third readings of each film would agree. So they sent one group of films to one center, second group to the second, third to the third. Then they would switch them. They'd keep on going until all centers had looked at all three groups of arteriograms. Remember that the doctor had told these people, oh boy, you've got to have a bypass right away because otherwise you're going to die. Well, in only 61% of the time did two or more of the three readings reach the same conclusion. That's phenomenal. So it's less than getting it half right. Finally, in phase three, 3 months later, the same 30 films were given to the same radiologists who were unaware that they had previously read the films at all. They didn't know. They thought these are new films. But they'd already had the written report out so that people could check it with the others. Now what happened? This time, 32% of the second evaluations differed from the first reading. So the cardiology chief at St. Luke's Medical Center, New York, this is what he stated, quote, "We had some of the best people reading the best quality angiograms available, and yet we get this result." Okay? So in spite of these and similar studies, angiograms remain the major criterion for bypass. Here's a guy, he got a target over his head, big question mark up here. They blindfolded him, and boy, if you go for the bypass, I would strongly suggest you read a book called Bypassing the Bypass first, okay? Okay, many people require a second bypass. Since the research indicates bypass vessels close in 40% of these people within 10 years of the initial surgery, sometimes often a lot sooner. I've seen it within 3 to 4 years, okay? The remaining 60% have developed further arterial narrowing of other arteries there. What's the solution? To prevent this, fish oil has been found effective. Do you know that fish oil is far more effective than taking aspirin without the side effects? Fish oil does a couple of things. You remember those platelets we showed you that can clump? Well, there's a product called thromboxane that helps them to clump. And fish oil knocks thromboxane down so it doesn't help them to clump.